Brilliant. Okay, so we're recording. So as I said, we're at the bottom of Heyomad Aleph 5a, and the line from our Mishnah is Veloze Vazeh Sheyesh Bohem Ruach Chaim. So our Mishnah started off with these four categories of damages, and then proceeded to go through each one and said that each one is slightly different. So Veloze Vazeh Sheyesh Bohem Ruach Chaim was just the first few words. The Gemara now is not focusing only on those words, but on that entire section of the Mishnah, which goes through and explains to us why each one of the categories is necessary and why each one is different from the other. Can everybody hear me? Someone just said they can't hear. Yeah, okay, great. So I'll assume it's on their end. What exactly is the Mishnah telling us here? So Omar Rav Masharshe Mishmei de Rava. Masharshe says in the name of Rava, Hachi ka Omar, this is what it means. Turning over the page. Lichtov Rachmona Tarte Vitese Idach Minayu. So the Gemara says, what the Mishnah is suggesting is let us basically just have two different Ovos Nazik and have two different categories, and we'll learn the rest from those two. So this is referring us back to the end of last week, where the Gemara had said that the stage before was suggesting maybe you can just have one of these written. Maybe you can just have one of the Ovos Nazik. Maybe you just have one category written, and we'll be able to derive the rest of them from that category. So now the Gemara, or the Mishnah, being interpreted by the Gemara, is going a stage further and said, okay, I understand that you can't just have one because we're going to have a problem. We're going to be missing some element or another. But what about two? And this is basically what we're going to dwell on for, I imagine, the entire shiur. Because as I said, we really go through this to try and figure it out. It took me quite some time to try and sort of get through this in detail, and really helps us to understand the differences and the sort of interplay between each of these categories. So again, the suggestion that Gemara is making is, and we definitely touched upon this in the Mishnah, but I don't think we went through it in detail, is that the Torah should have simply said two categories rather than four, or in reality a sort of six, because Shane and Regel often come together, or five, let's say, and the Mishnah should have simply said, or the Torah should have simply had two of them, and through that we'd have learned the rest. So the first thing, we haven't gone through what that means in detail, how that would have worked practically. The first response of the Gemara is just to simply explain the Mishnah. Hodar Omar, so now we're on the second line. Hodar Omar, Chadam Retarte Lo Osi, to learn one from two wouldn't have worked. There's no way we could have done that. So Omar Rava. Now Rava suggests a new thing, and this is what we're going to spend time on. Amar Rava, Rava responds, V'kulhu, all of them, Kishadisa Bar Minayhu. If you would have taken out Bar, if you just take out that category, so you have Torah explicitly mention Bar as a category of Nezek, of damages, then Osya Kulhu B'mehatzad. Then we could have learned all of them from this, with a mehatzad. A mehatzad is basically sometimes known as a memotzinu, sometimes known as a binyan av. Lots of different ways of presenting this, but it's a sort of a way in which there are many ways in which the Torah is interpreted. We list 13 of them in our davening. At the end, we talk about the yud gimel midos shatar and yudreshos behin, 13 ways in which we derive not rabbinic laws, but we derive Torah laws from the Torah. This is part of the oral Torah. And one of them is a memotzinu, a very, very classic one. This is the most classic one, perhaps. It basically means that it's a similarity. So this case is similar, X case is similar to what the Gemara said, to what the Torah has laid out. And therefore, they should be the same. So for instance, bur is a category of nezek, of damages. And the Torah says that you're liable to pay if you dig a pit in the Rosh Hashanah. Let's leave aside where you dig the pit. If you dig a pit, let's say Bar Rosh Hashanah classically is in the public domain. You dig a pit in public domain, and someone else's animal falls in and dies. You are liable to pay. That's what the Torah says. So If that's the case, so anything similar to that, memotino, right, we should be able to derive from that. Anything else, which is basically a, so we have to figure out what are the similarities, what exactly are the elements of bur that we're going to be considering to be similar to another. This is the way my one of my rabbin who I probably learned the most from, he used to explain this in a to me in what I found to be a very, very clear way. Many, many things in life have similarity. Everything in life has, you know, similarities and dissimilarities. But the question is, which are the key ones, as it were, right? So when you look at, you know, let's say you have a good footballer over here, and you want to know, you know that this person is a good footballer, and you want to know if that person's a good footballer. So one of the ways to, you might say, this person has black hair and he's a good footballer, so therefore anyone with black hair has a good footballer. So you and I know that that's a foolish, so yeah, that might be a similarity, but that's not relevant to this particular example. So what we're going to try, so what the Gemara is basically doing in this case is going to figure out which are the similarities which are key, which are the crucial elements of this which the Torah is requiring, and then basically figuring out, that's a memotzim, that is this Bameh Hatzad, which are the sides, Hatzad is literally a side, which are the sides, which are the elements, which are the parts that are similar and that are key and that we can actually use to derive from another. So at this stage, the Gemara is basically suggesting that, or Rava is suggesting within the Gemara, that if you have bur, if you have the category of bur of digging a pit and one other, right, that if you have bur and one other of then you should be able to derive it from a meh hatzad. You should be able to derive the rest from the meh hatzad. So let's just list off the rest of them for our purposes. So we have now Keren, Shane, Regel, Bur, and Ish. Right? So let's call them five for now. Although Shane and Regel might be stuck together. And with these five, the Gemara is suggesting that maybe we should just have two. So let's take an example. Now, you'll see, for those who are eagle-eyed, you look ahead. The Gemara goes on to say that maybe Keren should be taken out as an exception as well. We're going to come back to that. Let's go back to that. But for now, we'll just assume that Keren is one of the main is fits into this pattern. Okay, and let's just work it through slowly. So Rashi actually. You'll notice that this Omud of Gemara is very, very short, very little Gemara on it. And the reason is because there's an enormous amount of Rashi on it. And there's basically one Rashi, which we're not going to read inside, but I'd spent time going through, and basically I'd like to try and summarize outside to sort of go through the elements. What Rashi basically does is goes through this in detail and really just sort of tries to distill what it is about Bur and one other that may have worked in theory. As I said, later the Gemara is going to get rid of that. But in theory, let's try and figure that out. So let's take Keren as the initial example. Okay, so you have Bur and you have Keren. The Torah has told you that if you dig a pit in a Rishus HaRabim, you're liable to pay, and that if your animal gores, then you're liable to pay. Now we come along and we say, someone comes along to you and say, but my animal didn't gore anybody. Oh, sorry, his animal didn't gore anybody. Sharpen basically said, his animal came and ate my fruit, right? His animal came and ate my fruit. Is he liable to pay or is he not? So now we've got to figure out, is it similar to an animal goring and a pit in Rosh Hashanah or not? So the first element Rashi draws out is as follows. He says, you should be able to figure it out from the following. First by saying that a bur, a pit in, right, if I dig a pit, that is not, that doesn't move anywhere, right? It doesn't go anywhere. And therefore, if something which you know, I'm liable, one could argue that there's an element of fault with the person who's become damaged, right? I left something there, that's true, but they could have looked where they were going, or that animal could have looked where they were going, right? And therefore, if we're going to say that is liable, all the more so, something which goes to damage should be liable, right? So that's element number one, which Rashi, based on the Gemara's, draws out. That if that since this pit is not moving anywhere and it's liable, therefore any damage which is moving somewhere perhaps should be liable. But then you could respond to that and say, but a pit is designed to do damage, right? Not designed to do damage, but a pit is something that you look at as a hazard, right? It's a hazard. It's there. Okay, that makes sense that that's a hazard. And an animal is not a hazard. An animal is not a hazard. The animal which is walking around. So therefore, that doesn't work. And that's where we have this mehatsad. We have this, one is sort of plugging the hole of the other, as it were. So we have an element of bur which is lenient, which seems to work in our favor. It seems to work in our favor, or it seems at least to indicate that this animal which is eaten should be liable. And then we have this element of keren, of the animal goring, which also seems to indicate that the animal should be liable. So again, a pit doesn't move anywhere, and the animal that's gored is an animal, right? It's not designed, it's not a hazard. One doesn't look at that as a hazard, and therefore shein should work. But there's still another element missing. What's the other element that's missing? You could say that, yes, okay, but with an animal that gored, their intention was to cause damage, right? So whereas this animal was eaten, right? Neither designed to be a hazard, but it also didn't have any intention to damage. And there we have bur coming back and plugging that hole, and therefore we end up having, we have what seems to be a watertight argument, where we would say simply that because we have bur and keren, both of them laid out by the Torah as liable, so too, if you have shein, you wouldn't actually need to list it. Okay, you wouldn't need to list shein. That's basically what Rashi spends a long, long time going through and doing. So that was really, that's what I tried to draw out. That's what I tried to, I don't know if you could see my attempt over here. That's what I tried to draw out. These are basically the three elements that Rashi draws out in each one. Yes, we have a question.
Yeah, Rabbi, if we could say you can draw a lesson, one result from two examples, then surely you could say it's about a degree of foreseeability of damage. And then if you all you had is two examples saying that damage was foreseeable, whether it was trampling or whether it was pit or whether it was fire, surely that would be sufficient to actually say it was foreseeable, therefore the other things follow.
Okay. I mean, I think that's where we come back to this question of what are the characteristics that are key and which ones are not key. That's what Rashi is really drawing out for us based on the Gemara. The Gemara has laid out for us key elements of each of these categories, and none of them is it about does foreseeability seem to be the key element. So I said the key elements seem to be whether it moves to cause damage or it goes somewhere to cause damage. Another one is whether it's a hazard, whether it's considered to be what the Gemara terms as tchilas asios al nezek. It's sort of from its origin, it's almost there potentially to cause damage, or kavanos alahazik, whether its intention is to cause damage, i.e. an animal goring, right, is clearly not gaining any benefit, is just doing it for that sake. I've just got to plug in the computer one second. Yes. So I think those seem to be the key elements. Those seem to be, again, based, that's what...
I guess my point is that it's making it unnecessarily complicated.
I think you've got to, with all these cases, I don't know if it's unnecessarily complicated. Every case has dozens and, I mean, hundreds of elements to it. So the question is, which ones are the key ones and which ones are not? So you've boiled it down to foreseeability, but the Gemara is saying the Gemara is saying that is not the key element. That's not an element that we're focusing on. That's not one that the Gemara sees as crucial to make a person liable. Don't forget that when we talk about these categories, part of the reason why they're there as categories, part of the reason why we have cases as categories, is that they have unique elements to them, right? When we talk about a bur, when we talk about a pit, it's not just a random thing that the Torah sort of talks about a pit, but you know, Torah Shabbat Peh is telling us that the reason why the Torah is drawing the example, painting the picture for us of somebody digging a pit in a public place is because that is the key element there is that that is something that doesn't move, doesn't go anywhere, and still you're considered to be liable. When the Torah paints a picture for us of an animal going to gore someone else, the key element there is kavanos lazik, is going with intention to cause damage. So I think, as I said, that's what really the Gemara is drawing out here, that these are the key element. Or Rashi's doing this based on multiple Gemaras elsewhere. Our Gemara only had a line here or a line there, but our Gemara here has simply said that there are, that you can draw out the elements. It doesn't list the elements here. Rashi has based on, and it's not just Rashi, but Rashi sort of puts it very succinctly, or relatively succinctly, based on the elements that are drawn out in other Gemaras. These are the key elements that would have made it. I think we've encountered each of these phrases actually in our in just the last few daf. So each of these elements, when we talked about darko lahazik, normal, kavanasa lahazik, whether its intention is to damage, or tchilas asiyos lenezek, whether it's considered to be a hazard, all those are things that I think we've covered and mentioned in the past couple of daf. Rashi is just sort of bringing them together, wrapping them up to note.
Rashi's talking about three: hazard, moves to cause damage, and intention to cause damage.
That's in the case of Bor and Karen.
Yeah, but if you take move to cause damage, don't you then have two subsets? You move to cause damage without intention, and you move to cause damage with intention. So therefore, it's not three, it's two.
You're putting two together in a sense.
Yes.
I'm not sure they do match up together. I think they are separate elements. I mean, what are the two you're saying? If it moves to cause damage with intention to cause damage?
No, it moves to cause damage. It could be done for two purposes. One intentional and one isn't intentional.
Right, but let's say it moves. Those are two separate elements. So again, something which moves to cause damage, something which doesn't move to cause damage, or something which has intention to damage, something which doesn't have intention to damage.
But if it has intention to damage, it's either stationary, in which case it's a hazard, and if it's moving, it falls under the moving section.
I don't think intention is the same as a hazard. Certainly not the way the Gemara seems to.
So the intention to cause damage, is there movement, or is it the intention caused when it's stationary?
It could be either. I think that's the point. It's a separate element. I think this is why are we trying to put them together? Why are we trying to make it into two?
Well, it's a question of whether the intention to cause damage is done when you're moving or when you're not moving. If it's done when you're moving, it's part of the moves to cause damage. Just different.
Yeah, I think they're just separate elements. I think, again, you can have intention to cause damage whether moving or not, and you can have moves to cause damage whether it's intentional or not. And that's the point, is that each of those are independent of each other.
Sorry, can I have one last crack at this sustainability, and then I'll shut up. Let's go back to the example of the pit. If you dig a pit in front of a home for the blind, that obviously is foreseeable that it could or is likely to cause damage. If you dig a pit in the corner of town where very few people go, actually it's not bad, that's a bad example, in the middle of a town where people are regularly going who are fully sighted, and as you mentioned before, can actually skirt round provided it's fenced or whatever, doesn't that then come back and again support the case that it was foreseeable, therefore damage flow, therefore compensation needs to flow from it? I don't.
Well, I missed the last element. Foreseeable, and therefore.
I'm saying because it's foreseeable and that people get injured, then damages then flow.
So therefore, the person should be liable or not?
Yeah.
But so what's the foreseeable element? If it's foreseeable, then they shouldn't be liable.
No, if it's foreseeable, they should be liable. And if it wasn't foreseeable, then they shouldn't be liable.
When I dug the pit
outside the home for the blind, it's foreseeable that someone coming out their front door is going to get
hurt. Okay, so, and let's say I put it where it wasn't in a home for the blind. Let's say it was somewhere else.
Then it's also up to the citizenry or the people, the pedestrians, whatever, walking by it, to take care when they're out and about.
And therefore, you're saying they should be exempt.
Yeah,
but that's not what the Torah says.
I know, but I don't understand why someone should be exempt for something that they had no intent and it wasn't foreseeable that damage could be done.
Okay, I don't know. That's a separate point. Sorry, I misunderstood. We're not discussing. This is well off topic now, because the elements we're drawing out here is factually we have certain cases which the Torah has declared to be liable or exempt. I misunderstood what you were saying before. If the Torah has declared this to be exempt, you can go upstairs and have a discussion with him and let me know what he says. But that's not I can't answer for. I mean, we will actually come back to it to that was what I was trying to look up later, as to what extent we view these, and it is debated actually amongst the Rishonim, the sort of medieval commentators, to what extent we view these as what we call a gezeiras hakosev, which means a sort of a decree from on high, which is what it is, or that there is a logic to them that we can understand at least, and therefore we could perhaps say that, you know, in this case it applies and in this case it doesn't. To what extent there's those sorts of elements of wiggle room, we'll come back to some of those cases maybe later today or maybe next time. But in terms of the principle of, let's take your example exactly, digging a pit in, let's say, the middle of Cecil Park, right, where you could argue someone has to, everyone else should skirt around it. The Torah says everyone else shouldn't skirt around it. I mean, from a logical perspective, personally, I'm not sure I agree with you anyway. If I dig a pit in the middle of a road, I don't think it's fair to say everyone with eyes should be able to walk around it, and therefore I bear no responsibility for this at all. If you create a hazard, I've done that many times. You trip over someone's bag. Right, you trip over someone's bag that they left lying around. They left a hazard there, and you tripped over that. The fact that the person is able to see, I'm not sure that necessarily means. Like I said, there's two things here. Whether or not it's liable is not up for debate, because that we have the Torah has told us. Whether or not it's logical that it's liable, I'm not sure I agree with that either, because I think there's a lot. I think it's a good reason why you should be liable. You can maybe say that, there may be sort of elements of it. You know, we could say that depending on where it is, depending on how it's put there, what sort of signs you need, how big your hazard sign needs to be in front of it. Yes, you know, we can figure out the details. But in terms of the principle of its liability, personally, I think it makes a lot of sense, and as I said, that's not really what the Gemara is discussing, or not. Or the Gemara is saying, we know that you're liable for that case. We know that you're liable in the case of Bor. We know that you're liable in the case where your animal gores. Now let's put those two together. Would we automatically be able to figure out from there that you're also liable if your animal were to eat something? Right. That's what the Gemara is basically trying to do. And at this stage it's saying yes, you should be able to figure that out. You should be able to say that if someone's liable for digging a pit in the Rosh Hashanah Rabbin, and they're liable for the animal goring, then you should be able to distill the elements from there to figure out that actually the animals that you're liable when your animal eats something, because A, it moves just like Karen, B, it's even though it's not a hazard, so we know that it doesn't necessarily need to be a hazard to be considered liable, as we see from Karen, and it doesn't necessarily need to have intention to cause damage, as we see from Bor, from digging the pit, which is around your intention wasn't to cause damage, but it was a byproduct, and yet still you're liable, and therefore distilling those three elements Says the Gemara, or says Rashi, based on the Gemara, that you would be liable. But here we're going to hit a snag. Here we're going to hit a snag. And that is, the Gemara then, in the very next line, says that... So we're now four lines down, the fourth line down, on Heyamud Beis, 5b. Levar Mekeren, that all of this is just without, only if we can take Keren out of the equation, only if we can take an animal goring, that one needs to seemingly be on its own. Mishum Z'ikal Mifrach, because one could ask as follows, Malakuhu, all the rest of them, Shekein Muadin Mitchilosan, they are considered Muad Mitchilah, then that seems to be the element that makes it all come crumbling down. So let's just clarify what that means. So we said, until this point, we've said Bur and one other should work. But let's say we had Bur and Shane. Let's say we had the Torah only told you that you're liable for digging a pit in Rosh Hashanah, and it told you that you're liable when your animal eats. So then you could have learned all of them except for Keren, says the Gemara. Keren wouldn't have fit into that because Keren is what's called Muad Mitzchila. Sorry, all of the rest of them are what's called Muad Mitzchila. Now Rashi says as follows. Rashi says, I think it's buried actually deep into this. Okay, we're not going to look at the Rashi, but Rashi says, we'll look at the Tosas maybe very briefly. Rashi says that when the Gemara says Muad Mitzchila, it's the way I would have understood it without thinking about it very much. I mean, not meaning as an offense to Rashi, but it's the way that we initially would have thought of this, which means that it means all the rest of them are considered to be a Muad. What does it mean, a Keren Muad? Keren Muad, we know, is a case we've discussed before, where you're liable for the full payment, whereas the Tam, you're only liable half payment. It's this very strange quirk in Keren, which we've never quite got our head around. We haven't really got to the Gemara which deals with it yet. This strange quirk where you're only liable half payment for the beginning, for the first three times that an animal gores. So that's what Rashi says is the element that which seems to, where the whole thing seems to fall apart. But Tosus actually has a question on that. Tosus says that that's not really what we're talking about. So let's just, maybe we can just briefly look inside. An interesting short Tosus. So he says, so it's the Tosus talked about Shekein Muadin towards the bottom of the page. It's actually the first small Tosus. So you see there's a very big one to begin with. And then the next one is a bit smaller. Starts with the word Shekein. Shekein should be big. And it's sort of, yeah, three quarters of the way down the page. It says Shekein Muadin as follows. This is what that line means. Ein lefarish, she says, don't explain it. Shem Shalmin Nezek Shalem, that all of the rest of them pay full damages, as I've just said. De'im Kain, because if so, Keren Nami Osya, given the Loksiv, right? So Keren is also should fall into that category because it's not actually it hasn't been written, right? We're talking about, meaning from a logical perspective, he's saying that's a difficult presentation of the Gemara, because the Gemara is saying that we should be able to derive the liability of something from all the rest, and he's saying you can still derive liability. So we would have just derived liability of Keren, and we would have said that it was Muad, that you would pay full damages from the start. So that's nothing to do with liability. Amount of pay has nothing to do with liability. That's you're liable is like an on-off switch, right? Either you're liable or you're not. How much you're liable for, that's a quirk of Keren. But in terms of the liability itself, that should be either way. So Elam Aforish Rabbeinu Tam as follows. Rabbeinu Tam says that this is really what it means. Demuadin mitchilason, haynu shedarkon lahazik. What it means is that they're shedarkon lahazik, it's normal for them to cause damage. Masha'im came bekeren, he says. So this is interesting, and this actually comes back to this whole nezek shalim, this whole sort of half damages, full damages discussion which we've touched upon. He says, Masha'im came bekeren, Keren is not considered to be normal to damage. Distam shavarim, a regular ox, bechezkas, shimur kaimi, is considered to be is considered to be God. It's considered to be sort of under its owner's, its influence, under its owner's influence, and therefore it would be unusual for it to go and cause damage unnecessarily. And therefore that doesn't work. So Lamanda Omar, so that's why it doesn't seem to fall into this category, right? The rest of them is all normal damages. For an animal to go and eat something is normal. For a fire to go and cause damage is normal. But what the Gemara, what Tosa says the Gemara is saying is Shekein Muodin Mitchilas, and the rest of them is normal to cause damage, but this one is unusual to cause damage. But he notes that this only works Lamanda Omar Kalga Nizka Kenosa. So this is a debate which comes up in the Gemara on a little bit later, I think it's Daf 15 or so. And we haven't got to it. It's a Gemara which obviously we'll spend some time on, because this has been something which we've sort of struggled with and we've been trying to figure out, is that there's a big debate when it comes to the Chatzi Nezek, when it comes to an animal paying, damaging, causing, goring, right? An animal gores, and you pay half damages. Is that what's called Kalga Nizka Knossa? What he says as follows. It means that from a logical perspective, one should be exempt altogether. One should be exempt altogether. But the Torah says, you can't really say you're fully exempt. You can't really fully exempt a person, because the bottom line is their animal did gore in this case. But really, really, you should be exempt. But the Torah has sort of pushed it up a level, as it were. So it's giving you half damages. Or you have the reverse. Or you have the exact opposite perspective. So the Torah is saying, Palga Niska Mamona. That the Torah is really saying that you should be liable for the whole thing, right? Your animal has caused damage, and you should have predicted that. You should have predicted that your animal would cause damage. So, therefore, you should be liable for full damages. But the Torah is going to give you a little bit of a break. Yes, it's true that it's slightly unusual. It's true that maybe you could have a little bit of a break here. That it was a bit of a surprise that your animal did go and cause this damage, and therefore you're only going to pay half damages, and it sort of brings it down a notch rather than up a notch. So this is a very, very important debate when it comes to Chatzi Nezek, when it comes to an animal only paying half damages the first three times. Should you really be liable fully, and the Torah simply brings it back, gives you a little bit of a break because of the slight element of surprise, or the opposite, or you should be shouldn't be liable at all, but the Torah pushes it up. The Torah says, yes, okay, it's very unusual for an animal to do this sort of damage, but we're still going to give you a little bit of the liability. We're going to charge you half damages because it's not totally out of the realm of possibility. So it's sort of a zero plus or a one minus, as it were. That's really the two sides of the debate. And Tosis is saying that our Gemara is very much, or at least this stage of our Gemara, seems to be siding with the opinion that it's zero plus. Right, that he's saying Shekein Muadim Mitchilosan means that all the rest of the damages that we're talking about are predictable, are things that are normal to be done, whereas Keren, he's saying, is unusual to be done. It's a surprise, and therefore that's basically the entire liability would have been difficult to learn out from even from two others, even Bor and one other, still wouldn't have made the jump to Keren. So now the Gemara responds, and then we'll stop for questions. I just want to go to the Gemara's response, and then we'll pause for questions. Ulamanda Omar Adaraba. So now, again, this is Tosus's proof. He's saying, Ulamanda Omar, what about we have another opinion? So Tosus says this is a reference to the opinion later on Daf 15, that it should be one minus, that you really should have been liable for the full amount, and the Torah gave you a bit of a break. Other Abba, Keren Adifa, Keren is even stronger. Keren all the more so should have been liable, Shekavah Nosa Lahazek, because its intention is to cause damage. So Afilu Keren Nami Asya, and therefore we would have been able to learn out even from Keren as well. So Bor and Keren, Bor and Shane, Bur and Regel, Bur and Ish, any of them, you'd have been able to pick Bur and one other and been able to derive each of those elements. Okay, so that's that. The only reason I wanted to bring that to us is just to sort of just to reference that crucial debate, which as I said, we'll come back to later on as to whether this is 0+ or 1-. And now we've reached this point in the Gemara where it seems to be that perhaps we could learn Bur and one other. If you just had two written in the Torah, that would be enough. If you just had two written in the Torah, you'd be able to distill the elements and create a liability for the others. So in which case, we're left with the Gemara is going to have to figure out, why do we need to talk about the rest? Why does the Torah talk about all of them? Should just talk about Bur and one other and would have been able to figure out the rest of them logically. All right, any questions? Okay, so Elo Lamai Hilchasa. What exactly, so Elo Lamai Hilchasa, right? So why exactly do we have all of these, right? What is the point of having this extended list? Not list, sorry. Why does the Torah have all these Kasvin Rachmana? Why does the Torah detail all these other categories as well as Bur? We should have just sufficed with Bur and one other. So the Gemara responds, Lehilchosehen, because each of them has an element. Lehilchosehen, the details of each one is slightly different. And here, okay, we're going to spend a lot. We're going to have to, each of these, the Gemara is going to sort of, not here, but the Gemara later, it will go through each of these and figure out what exactly, why each of these has their unique elements, but for now we're just going to simply present it as what they are. And the Gemara basically details the exceptions and the uniqueness of each of these categories, and they are as follows. Karen, what is the uniqueness of Karen? So Karen, at least we know, okay? We know the uniqueness of Karen. Lechalek ben toma lemuedes, as we've talked about in the past, that for the first three times an animal gores, then you only pay half damages, and for the rest, you pay full damages. Okay, whatever troubles we've had with that or not. So that's what that's one difference. That's why Karen is its own exception, seems to fall into its own category. Shein v'regel, which seem to come together. Shein v'regel, lepotron v'rishus harabim. So shein v'regel are exempt. We haven't encountered this, I don't think. Until this point, but basically what the Gemara says here is that Sheva Regel have a unique element that they are exempt in Rosh Hashanah, in a public place, i.e. if an animal breaks into your field, or not even breaks in, but simply wanders into your field and eats your cherries off the tree, then I'm liable to pay as its owner. But if you leave out some food in the public domain and my animal comes along and eats it, then I'm not liable. Right, so if you leave a bundle of hay in your front garden, or not in your front garden, because that might be considered your property, but let's say in the middle of the street, then that is, I'd be exempt, and so too with Regel, right? So if an animal tramples something in private domain, then it's liable, but if it tramples something in the public domain unintentionally, right, just as it's walking, and it walks over, you know, your minvars, right, which you left in the middle of the road, then I would be exempt, whereas in private property, I would be liable. Okay, so that's the element of Shein V'Regel. Then, Bur, what's the unique element of Bur? Bur lifto bur sakelim. So this is, again, one which we're going to have to spend time on figuring out, but based on the verses, based on the Pasuk basically says, Chamor, Shor o Chamor, your bull or your donkey, your ox or your donkey, and from there the Gemara derives that kalim, that this excludes your utensils, right, or something. So let's say, for instance, I dig a pit in the middle of the road and an animal falls in and is carrying something on its back, so I'm liable to pay for the animal, but I'm not liable to pay for the damage caused to your laptop, which was in its bag, right, let's say, for example. So I'm not liable for that. And presumably the reason for that is, I mean, from a logical perspective, I don't know, we would have to come back to this, but presumably the reason is that when we talk about a pit and a and an immovable damager and an immovable damagee, right, then there's got to be something else there, because the pit is not moved anywhere and the laptop shouldn't be moving anywhere, right? So on their own, they don't seem to be clashing at all, right? It's only because of your animal, as it were, that this is actually, the damage is being caused. So potentially that's why. I'm not sure, that's just my, as I said, that's just off the cuff. But that's the unique element of Bor. Ulo Rabbi Yehuda, Gemara says that we actually have a debate about this. Rabbi Yehuda disagrees. Rabbi Yehuda the Mechayev al Niske Kalim, he says that you are liable for damages done to the utensils. So what's the unique element of Bor? So he says, no, Bor, Lifter Bor, Sa'odom. He says that you're actually not liable for human damages, right? For a person, the person falls in there. This comes back to Andy's point, right? This comes back to Andy's point that, maybe I should have been clearer before, that there is this opinion, and I actually think we follow this opinion, unless I'm mistaken, come back to it, that if a person falls in a pit, that again, the person should have been able to see it, right? So the person actually would be, you would be exempt, the owner of the pit, or the person who dug the pit would be exempt. It's only when we talk about animals falling into the pit, then you'd be liable, right? But the person falling into the pit, you'd actually be exempt. And so that is, so that's the unique element of Bor. Adam, what about human damages? So this is what we've talked about. Also, we've touched upon this in the past, that when we talk about a person causing damage, then they actually are liable to pay not just the basic damages, but significant other elements as well, the medical bills and the boshes, the embarrassment caused, and psychological damage, all those sorts of things all comes along, and therefore that has its own uniqueness, and therefore needs to have its own verse as well, seems to have its own liability from the Torah. Eish, what about Eish? What about fire causing damage? Lifter versus Atomun. So when I light a fire, I'm exempt on something that was hidden. Okay, this is the element that's different when it comes to Eish. So if I light a fire and it spreads, then anything that's hidden wouldn't be liable. So, for instance, I burn my chometz. I decide I'm going to burn my chometz, make a big bonfire out in the back garden, and the fire spreads and goes into your garden and destroy, or your field, let's say, and destroys all your crops. So I'm liable for the crops. Let's say that you hid your something in your haystack. I don't know. You hid a big stash of cash, let's say, right? You hid your most recent winnings, right? In your haystack, right? And all of that goes up in flames as well. So I'm not liable for that. Anything that's hidden away, then you're not liable for that when it comes to Eish. And again, this will be something which we'll have to discuss in the Gemara. Ulo Rabbi Yehuda, again, Rabbi Yehuda disagrees. He has his own opinion. Demechayev al Niske Tomen, he says you are liable when it comes to hidden things. So Be'esh la'asuyimai, why does Eish need to have its own specific verse? Why does Eish need to have its own unique element? So turning over to Daf Vav 6a, right, we're flying here. We're going to hold a moment. La'asuyei lichecha niro v'sichsecha avano. Because it's specifically coming to include where you a nir is okay, maybe it's not. I thought nir meant something else, but all the commentaries say that what it means is as follows, that I had, if it destroys your field, if it destroys the crops on your field, then that makes sense. But here we're just talking about, let's say, just sort of burnt the crust off, as it were, burnt the sort of the top off. So I had, for instance, plowed my field already. I hadn't planted anything. There's no crops in there. There's no tangible damage. But I plowed it already. And because of this fire, it's now sort of made the earth move around a little bit. It's all burnt off the top of the earth. And therefore, I'm going to have to plow again. I'm going to have to do that work again. So that's what Rabbi Yehuda is saying is the element that's different, that you would actually be exempt in that. The sichsecha avonav, all of your stones became blackened, right? Your stones became blackened. So again, they're not burning, they've not disappeared, they've not been destroyed, but they've become blackened. And again, you could argue it both ways, but Rabbi Yehuda is saying that this is he's saying that you're chayev in these cases, la'asuye, excuse me, to include. Rabbi Yehuda is taking this a step above, that not only are you liable for, when it comes to Aish, for the damage caused in someone's field, but you're also liable even for these sort of, not full senses of damage, right? You've simply blackened someone's stones, or you've unplowed their field effectively through the fire, suddenly moved around the dirt and unplowed their field. So Rabbi Yehuda is saying that that is the unique element of Aish. That's what's been added in, and that's why Aish needs to be listed separately in the Torah. Bottom line of all of this is, any questions? And then maybe we'll just wrap up and conclude a few minutes early, or we'll start, maybe we'll kick off with the next one. Yeah, let's see how it goes.
Going back to this man with a pit, if you put the pit in the middle in the middle of the road, or next to the pavement, and the guy walking along tries to avoid a horse coming at him and falls into the pit, whose fault is that?
It's a good question.
Sorry, I'm making it more complicated.
A rock in a hard place, as it were.
A horse. Of course.
Also, the a more serious question is that if you dig a pit, you ought to mark it, the fact it is a pit, purely out of common sense, and whatever. Just simply have a pit and assume as the guy goes by, he can see it. Is kind of, in other words, I still think, and so I agree with Andy, that it is the guy digging the pit that's responsible, even though for human beings, because if you look at modern day stuff, you've got balls and all sorts of things around it. It's to simply dig a pit and assume everybody sees it. It's a bit helpful.
The opposite.
To me, this is a charter to evade liability. I mean, quite clearly, it says even if a blind person falls in the pit, he's not liable. Of course, he's got to be liable.
Oh no, the blind person might be a different case. Now that's a different thing. But
Rabbi,
yes. But one second, just to clarify, I think that this seems to be a debate as to whether, leaving aside someone who is able to see the pit, should be that's this debate basically, Rabbi Huda and the other opinion, as to whether we would be liable or not. As I said, we're going to have to come back to that. In terms of George's first question, it's a very interesting question. I would think that we would say that it's no different. Yeah, again, if you're not liable, it should never be the person who made the pit, as it were, who is liable, because if it's not something which you're liable to do, then it doesn't matter whether it was caused by somebody. In a sense, the fact that it's caused by somebody else, caused by someone else's horse coming down the road, then you'd argue that that person would be liable. Now, you may say from the beginning that the person who dug the pit should be liable already. So that's going to come back to this basic debate as to whether you're liable for people falling into the pit or not. I think we also, this is the other element, and then I'm going to hand over to Phil. Is that we also need to bear in mind with all of these things that this is talking about, not talking about 21st century London, which may have slightly different elements, right? There's an extent to which you get used to societal norms, right? You get used to sort of the way in which the world works, right? I can't claim to have lived in this sort of time, but you know, once upon a time, we're talking about a place where there's, where you're walking across fields to go and meet your friends, right? We're not talking about walking along paved roads where you assume that everything is going to be flat as a pancake when you're walking. There's an element to which you already got to be quite careful when you're walking, and the fact that there is a pit here, I just think we need to sort of, I'm not arguing one way or another right now. I think we need to come back to it when we deal with that tomorrow, but I just want to just remind us that we need to bear that in mind when we're talking about this, that we're not talking about a pit being dug in the middle of what otherwise should be a beautifully paved road. We're talking about a pit being dug in a, you know, in a bumpy field, let's say, for example, right, in the middle of a bumpy field. Phil's been waiting, so I'm just going to let Phil
I was going to say that we started off by distinguishing between different tortious acts and thinking that we might be able to identify primary torts and then torts that you can derive from those primary torts.
Right.
But what we're talking about here has got nothing to do with the primary tortious act. It's got to do with one exception, with defences to what otherwise would be situations where damages would be incurred. And the one exception, each of Keren, Shane, Bohr and Aish is in fact a defence, a different type of defence to what otherwise might be a liability. The one exception is Adam. And Adam is actually an example here where the scope of one's liability is increased.
Right.
Beyond what it might be. And that is the, you know, if you were looking for two different sorts of primary, how to distinguish between two primary cases, I'd say, really, to think about these in terms of trying to distinguish the different tortious acts is not really what this is about at all. This is really all about defences to claims for damage. I mean, I think the clue is in the fact it's Nezikin. It's that we're talking about damages, but we've come about it in a very roundabout way, because we were talking about the acts, the tortious acts themselves, rather than about the consequences that flow from the action that has occurred. But really, what this is concentrating on are the consequences that flow. Well, because it's damage, because each one of these cases is about a defense to damages. It's not about the actual nature and quality of the act. Keren is about damage.
I've not done any, again, leaving aside Adam as an example.
Yeah.
Right? Let's say in the case of a Keren, for example.
Yeah.
I've not done anything, really. The point is that the police come along and knock on my door and say, "Excuse me, sir."
No, you've not done anything, but the beast has done something. Okay, right. So and you are liable for your beast's acts.
Right.
What I'm saying is that really what this is examining is not the nature and quality of the act, but the consequence that flows from that act. So it's sort of saying, look, the act is the act. Was it in a public place or was it in a private place? Was this an animal that did something, done something before, or was it an animal that had never done something before? And we're differentiated between these cases by reference to the various defences that there might otherwise be to damage caused by those acts.
I'm not sure I see it. The question is that we're trying to build. As you said before, categories, in a sense. We're trying to build sort of a classic example. The way that the Torah, to a large extent, and even more so the Gemara, works is it doesn't say why this is an interesting. I think we could spend a long time discussing why this is. I have my own thoughts. But be that as it may, the Torah doesn't give us a sort of a legal sentence of you will be liable in all cases where the following elements are true. What it says is this is the classic case in which a person would be liable or exempt or whatever it is, and from there we've got to figure out what are the elements to take away from that. So far as I understand, the Gemara is basically saying that these are the classic cases. The classic cases are an animal goring with one exemption, or an animal eating, let's say, but in a specific place, or a person digging a pit, but again with a drawback. So that's all we've done. It's just refined the classic case in which a person is liable.
And it seemed to me here, once talking, take Karen, we're not really talking about the. We're actually talking about a situation where what is a situation where goring is going to make you liable and where it's not going to make you liable?
No, so goring was a slightly different one. Goring was about whether it's the first three, you again.
Well, okay, let's take trampling. Take Shane, okay? Eating and trampling, okay? What are the cases where eating and trampling is going to make you liable and where you won't be liable? It's a public place and a private place.
Right.
Yeah. So what I'm saying is what we're defining it by reference to is a defense to damages, not the act itself. The eating is the eating. The trampling is the trampling.
I don't think that's true. Where you are affects what it is. It's like saying eating is different depending on where you are and when you are.
It's not. The eating is the same.
I don't think it is. I'm sorry. If I'm eating my food in my house, it's not the same as me eating your food in your house. It's different. It's a different thing.
Well, what are you asking? What are you defining? Are you defining the quality of eating, or you define the quality of the consequences of the consumption? The eating is the eating, whether you eat in my house or in your house.
I don't think the action is. I still don't see the action as the same. The action is different depending on where it is.
Eating is eating. We don't have two different words for eating because wherever you eat, you do the same thing. You eat.
But that's because you're focusing on one element of it.
What I'm saying is that we're not actually focusing on the nature and the quality of the eating here. What we're doing is, it seems to me, is we're looking at the consequences of the eating, and we're defining areas where there's liability and where there's not liability. In other words, we're defining defences.
I don't see that. I think we're talking about the case. We're giving the act is eating in a private place. That is an act. So you're trying to. I mean, so far as I understand it, you're limiting the act to eating, because that is one particular. You know, that's one word. But the act is a broader act than that. Where it is taking place is part of the act.
I'm not trying to limit the act to eating. What I'm saying is that what we're focusing on here is not the eating. It's the defences to the consequences.
Leave aside eating. We're not talking.
Okay.
Let's say we're talking about consuming. So drinking, you know, drinking is not eating, let's say, right? So I don't know if it is or it's not. I'm not sure how you're going to define that. I'm not sure how limiting you are making this act. The point is it's consumption, right? So it is consuming something. I mean, in theory, you could say it about, I'm not sure what animal would do this, but I mean, in theory, you say the same thing about.
But the Gemara here, call it consumption, call it Shane, call it whatever you like, is talking about doing it Barishas Arabin.
Right.
Okay. So really, it's not the quality of the eating that is an issue here. It's okay. It's the consequences of where you do it.
I think both are true. It's got two elements here. It's got multiple elements. And the question is, which are the ones that we're focusing on? So, for instance...
Well, I think here we're just focusing on that. I think it's just the damages. We're not actually focusing on the... Because you said yourself, it could be eating, it could be drinking.
It could... Let's... Okay.
I think Phil's got a point.
I still can't quite understand. But again, I don't see them as different. There is a class...
And I'll tell you, Rabbi, when I first learned contract law, okay... Crazily, the guy who taught me contract law didn't start with what a contract is. He started by teaching me about damages.
Right.
And I said, why? It's a really crazy way to learn about what a contract is. And here we're not talking about contracts, we're talking about torts. But I think what we're really doing is we're looking at the consequences of acts. We're not actually looking at the And it helps me. It helps me.
Define for me consequences. What do you mean by?
Well, your animal's ravenously hungry, and you know, as animals tend to be, they eat all the time. The cow eats in the field. I leave my gate open, and the cow goes into a public thoroughfare, and he sees a truck of mangel wurzels, and he, you know, that belong to some chap who's taking them to market, and he chomps on them and eats up all the mangel wurzels.
Right.
Now, the consequence there, the eating is the eating. I mean, animals eat. You expect animals to eat, but the consequence is that he's eaten someone else's produce. It was in the Rushas Arav, and he should be liable because he should have probably closed the gate to make sure that the cow didn't get out.
But again,
not talking about the eating. That's talking about we're focusing on the consequences.
Okay, I'm going to pause, and then the first thing I want to say is that I think we've reached a good stopping point. So anyone who wants to leave is welcome to leave. I'm going to keep the recording on because I think it's an interesting discussion. And feel free to leave whenever you want. Just to come back to your point, Phil, does it help if I say, okay? So let's say we're focusing on the consequences. Maybe I'm misunderstanding. So let's say that's what we're doing. We're focusing on the consequences. It's almost like we're playing semantics here. So we're focusing on the consequences. And the key is, what exactly has happened here?
Well, we started off by asking ourselves whether there were different heads. Are these different heads? Okay. We've been scratching our own heads a bit about that, but I couldn't quite understand why you wouldn't start off an analysis like this from first principles and saying, you know, what is damage, what's the nature of damage? That's how the Greeks would do it, isn't it? That's exactly how the Greeks would do it. So I'm thinking to myself, well, what's the logic here? What are they? How are they really defining this? I think it's coming at it from the other end. I think it's looking at what are the consequences that flow from actions, and are there different types of consequences that flow, and can we define these? Can we define all of this by reference to those consequences?
Okay, it's an interesting one. I mean, in terms of why the Gemara chooses this way of presenting it, I mean, you could write a doctorate on and more. Write multiple doctorates on why every Masechta really, why it begins with the way it begins, and why, you know, the sort of the order in which it appears is very, very difficult to figure out. And I think part of it is actually that there's no. I don't think I think in sort of fundamental belief, it doesn't believe there is a starting point per se. It's all because it's part of, where do you start on a puzzle, as it were? You know, like, what is the starting point of a puzzle? There is no starting point, right? You're just sort of thrown into the sea and make it, you know, sink or swim a little bit. But that's a slightly separate thing. In terms of this, the way I see it, and I don't know if this is helpful, is they're almost like presenting scenarios, right? It is. It's almost as though, you know, we're sitting there as the Beit Din, as it were, you know, and someone comes along and says, this is what happened. So we take all the elements of that presenting scenario and figure out what exactly has gone on, right? So that's what the head categories are. The head categories are the following has happened. It's case law, effectively. The following has happened. The Torah says you're liable in this case. What else do we distill from this to sort of apply it in different other ways? So it's almost like, rather than it also comes back to the points before about a person making defense or not making a defense. I think that's also a sort of that's the way courts. You'll tell me, but as far as I understand, it's the way courts work here, where you sort of construct your own defense. In a Beis Din, you never construct your own defense. The Beis Din, as it were, constructs all the defenses for you, in a sense. They're supposed to construct the defenses for and against on both sides, and be able to tell you the sort of the reasons why and the reasons why not, and try and, in a sense, try and find the reason why each side should or shouldn't be liable. So they're not really defences that are presented by one person or another. The cases are the cases, and we figure out what exactly are the elements that are crucial within this case and which ones are not. But I'm not sure if I'm being helpful now, actually. I feel like I'm... Yes.
Yeah, Robert, can I sort of jump in as well?
I'm going to... One sec. Andy, do you want this to be on the recording or not?
Yes, up to you. You can stop it. It's fine.
I'm going to stop it because I'm not sure if it's being helpful for everybody else. Yeah.